From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. 8 years ago, Amnesty International ranked Georgia 50th out of 50 for maternal mortality. Since then, the problem has grown worse. The latest numbers from the State Department of Health found that pregnancy-related and associated death is more likely in Georgia than in Uzbekistan. Behind that statistic are people, like Wanda Irving, a consultant and mediator living in metro Atlanta. Her daughter, Shalon, died after giving birth to a baby girl, Soleil, in 2017. And Wanda's joining us on the line. Wanda, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Brianna Lipscomb is U.S. Maternal Health Campaign Manager for the Center for Reproductive Rights, one of the organizations working to improve outcomes for women, and is with me in the studio. Brianna, thank you so much for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Wanda, start with you. Of course, so many people listening have never met Shalon. What was she like?
Oh, Shalon was an amazing person. She was bright. She was vibrant. She was strong. She had a dual, a PhD, two masters. She'd gotten them all summa cum laude before 26 years old. She was just an amazing woman who had just a deep love for women's health and health equity. She was a member of the globally recognized Epidemic Intelligence Service. She was a well-respected epidemiologist at the CDC. Besides the professional, she was an accomplished author. She had numerous scientific articles. She'd made contributions to several books written by her colleagues. She co-authored a book that we recently got published. She was well-rounded, a photographer, a gardener, an entrepreneur. She just launched a consulting startup, and she was my best friend and my travel buddy. We traveled to over 20 international countries in just the last 5 years, and she had wanted to start that love of travel with her daughter. We had a trip planned to Dubai that was supposed to start 5 days after she died. She was truly, truly an amazing, amazing woman.
Yeah, and doesn't fit the picture that we might have of, you know, a 21st century woman who dies in complications from pregnancy. She was thrilled when she became pregnant at age 36. You were with her during the birth, and I know you're still taking care of her daughter, Soleil,
who we hear in the background.
But to a much sadder occasion, what happened after the birth of Soleil?
After Soleil was born, Shalon was so excited to get home. I think it was 5 days after the birth, she developed a painful hematoma. She went back and forth to the doctor for that, and it wasn't healing. And then a few days after the hematoma, she started to feel not herself. She complained of headaches, weight gain, difficulty in urinating, and her blood pressure just kept rising. She kept going back to the doctor over and over again during those last 2 weeks, and was sent home saying, "Oh, it's you. Just wait, wait. It'll get better. You just had a baby. There, you know, no need to worry." And just that kind of dismissal, even though she kept telling them, "You know, I know my body. I know there's something wrong. I'm not feeling well. I'm not urinating. I'm drinking gallons of water, and I'm not going to the bathroom. My legs are swelling. My blood pressure is rising. I've got headaches. There's something wrong." And yet she was sent home. Even the day that she had the cardiac arrest, she had been to the doctor 5 hours before that, only to be sent home.
Oh, Wanda, I'm so sorry. I'm wondering for you, Brianna, have you heard stories like this before?
We've definitely heard similar stories through focus groups that we've done and other work with just community partners. We're hearing that a lot of Black women in particular, even when they have access to care, the quality of care that they receive when they access those services is not ideal. And that impacts their desire to even go back for services, but it is also impacting directly the outcomes that we're seeing.
Well, it is striking. In Georgia, African-American women, 3 to 4 times as likely to die from pregnancy-related complications. NPR's Renee Montagne did some very thorough reporting on this issue with ProPublica. She spoke with Dr. Michael Liu. He was then director of the Maternal and Child Health Bureau for Health and Human Services about what the stress of racism can do to the body.
We're talking about African-American doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they still have higher maternal mortality rate than white women who were high school dropouts. It's the experience of having to work harder than anybody else just to get equal pay and equal respect. It's being followed around when you're shopping at a nice store or being stopped by the police when you're driving in a nice neighborhood. Those types of experiences create a kind of chronic stress that continues to gun the engine, which over time create the wear and tear on your body's systems.
Brianna, your organization has worked with Yale Global Health Justice Partnership to report on race disparity in maternal mortality. This is part of a growing field of study about what's called weathering. It actually weathers ages the body. So what are we learning?
Well, we're learning, number one, that maternal health is a very complex issue. And as long as we only address the clinical aspects of it, we're not going to move the needle. And so to your point about weathering, you have women that are exposed to these stressors throughout life, and that is impacting their health before they even step into a hospital. And so until we are able to address those systemic issues that are impacting health for women, particularly Black women, we're not going to see the closing of that disparity gap.
Well, and it's not just Black women, but women in general in the state of Georgia. Why is the statistic so high, maternal mortality for women in Georgia?
That's a great question. And I think that we're still in the process of trying to figure that out. As part of the Maternal Health and Rights Initiative for the Center for Reproductive Rights, one of our policy priorities is to improve the data quality around maternal mortality. And so we're supportive of the maternal mortality review committees that are being put in place. Georgia finally passed legislation in 2014 to have such a committee in place. But I think it's important for us to also make sure that the people represented on those committees are diverse, and that the communities most impacted by an issue are present as part of those policy and program discussions. Because right now we can look at medical charts and try to figure out, you know, what were the medical causes, but what were the issues leading up to that? And until we're able to answer those questions, we're not going to be able to effectively address the issue.
We're talking about Georgia's last in the nation ranking for pregnancy-related deaths with Brianna Lipscomb, we just heard from, and also Wanda Irving, who lost her daughter after giving birth to a baby named Soleil. This was in 2017. Brianna, I just wanted to mention, you just talked about the state of Georgia is doing something about it. The state allocated funding for the problem only last year, $100,000 in healthcare budget to address the problem statewide. This year, $2 million. What is that money being used for?
So to my knowledge, the funds are being used to help a lot of the rural hospitals get up to speed, up to date on how to address these issues. You know, one of the leading causes, or a few of the leading causes of maternal mortality specifically related to pregnancy, are hemorrhage and hypertensive issues. And so to get our rural hospitals equipped, both with staff capacity, but also with, you know, real equipment in the hospital to address these issues in an appropriate manner is important. And so the $2 million is going towards quality improvement initiatives, often led by the Alliance for Innovation in Maternal Health, which is great. And so we're excited to see that progress. But I also think it's important to note that we've seen several hospital closures in our rural areas in Georgia, which impacts a woman's ability to access maternity care in a timely manner. And then we're also still seeing a lot of deaths occur in urban settings. And so we want to make sure that we're addressing those populations as well.
Yeah, Wanda, your daughter was in Metro Atlanta. Also looking at her Twitter bio, I see inequity wherever it exists, call it by name and work to eliminate it. So this is disparity was something that she was particularly focused on at her work at the CDC, among other things. Now, we can't say with any certainty that if she were white, she would be alive. But do you think race played a role in her death?
I don't think race killed her. I think it was the fact that doctors did not take race into consideration that made the difference.
So meaning that did they respond to her? Did they? Her health had been pretty good. She'd had a couple of complications in her life.
Right. But they didn't respond to her. They didn't take into consideration that she was an African-American woman and that there were stressors that the body had been undergoing and that they should look at the history and put the pieces together. I think where the mistakes were made were in the fact that they were looked at in a vacuum. Her symptoms were looked at in a vacuum and not really put together and say, oh, this is happening, and this is happening. We need to consider that there is something wrong here and look deeper.
Brianna, of course, prenatal care is a big part of what women pay attention to and doctors pay attention to in pregnancy. How about a postpartum plan?
So, you know, women are encouraged to go in for a postpartum visit. And I know just across the U.S., at times we struggle with making sure that women actually come back for that visit, right? But the other problem with that is that one visit is expected to assess everything for a woman after she delivers. And we know that maternal mortality, we look up to 1 year postpartum. But for many women on Medicaid, their coverage only goes up to 60 days postpartum. So after that postpartum visit, if they need any other care or any other services, because Georgia is one state that did not expand Medicaid, they have no access to those services. And that's a major concern, because if there's complications outside of those 60 days, what is she to do?
Yeah, and that is something that Stacey Abrams said has made a big part of her campaign is the Medicaid expansion. But I want to end with you, Wanda. So tell us about Soleil. She sounds like a lively young sweetie girl.
Oh, boy. She's before I do that, I just wanted to also say, though, that postpartum visit is too late. Had my daughter had a postpartum visit at 3 weeks, she might still be here. The 6 weeks, 6 months, whatever, is too late. My granddaughter is an amazing young girl. She is learning to speak. She has a wide vocabulary, and she's also taking French lessons. She's a wonderful ballerina and a gymnast. So she is, but she misses her mom. We talk about her on a regular basis. There are pictures everywhere in the house of her mother. She knows who her mother is. But she doesn't know where her mother is. And one day she was at Gymboree, and a woman kept asking, where's your mother? Where's your mother? Because she didn't see me sitting right there. And Soleil looked at me like, what am I supposed to say, Grandma? And I almost lost it. And it's times like that I just, you know, wish she had known what an amazing mother she had. But she has a lot of her mother in her. She's strong, she's vibrant, she's active, and she's surrounded by love by, you know, the village her mom had put together before she died.
Oh,
and
Wanda,
by her family.
Thank you so much for speaking with us, Wanda Irving. Really appreciate your time, and all the best to you and Soleil.
Thank you.
Brianna Lipscomb, she's U.S. Maternal Health Campaign Manager for the Center for Reproductive Rights. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Now, we do have a link to special correspondent Renee Montaigne's reporting, including photos of Wanda and Soleil. That's at gpbnews.org. And from closing the inequity gap in maternal health care to a more successful campaign, when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. When reconceptualizing a reinstallation of its collection, Atlanta's High Museum of Art looked to the community for inspiration. The recent rotation of works reflects Atlanta demographics, putting more art by women, people of color, and LGBTQ people on view. It's part of a push to change the overwhelming whiteness of most museum environments and make theirs more truly representative, accessible, and inclusive. Kevin Tucker is chief curator at the High Museum, and he's here to talk about the reinstallation, among other things, which is now open to the public. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Arts ATL contributor and host of a podcast for the Spelman College Museum of Art, Floyd Hall. Hello, Floyd.
Good morning.
So glad to have you here, both here. But Kevin, I'm going to start with you. How has the High Museum of Art's audience changed in recent years?
It's changed rather dramatically, and this has really been an initiative of ours in recent years, led by the museum's director, Rand Suffolk, since his arrival in fall of 2015, to redirect the museum's attention and resources to representing the diversity that is Atlanta, that is our state. And there have been great strides in that regard in terms of our audience and who is coming to the museum in reflecting people of color, certainly that correspond to the demographics of the city of Atlanta, even more so. Whereas before, the High was perhaps had an audience of somewhere around 15% people of color visiting. We are now at 45 to 50%, which certainly is much more in line with where the city of Atlanta is at 51% minority-majority representation. And that's really due to where we have shifted our programming mm-hmm. and where we have underscored what we have been doing in previous years in terms of making inroads into developing the collections and exhibitions to represent that greater diversity.
Here's a little bit from Rand Suffolk, who took over, as you said, as the museum director, speaking to NPR about how they pulled that off three times the amount of diverse audience as when he started.
Our staff got together and they did a remarkable job of saying, you know, what should our voice be as an institution? And they came back and said, you know, we're a Southern institution. We're very proud of that. There should be more Southern hospitality in terms of the way we engage with people. There should perhaps be more humility about the way we're talking about ourselves and with individuals that are out there. And ultimately, we came up with a tagline called Here for You, that we just want to put it out there, that everything that we do is really intended to be audience focused.
So the High diversified its docent pool, its ad campaign is multilingual, so trying to get locals in the door. But you, Kevin, joined when the rotation of its collection was happening, so they're pulling works unseen out of the collection. How does changing that physical space change the experience of somebody who visits?
Well, it was certainly a change that was long overdue for multiple reasons, and certainly one of the leading reasons, of course, is to better represent what the museum has been doing in the 13 years since its last reinstallation of the collection in 2005, and what the museum has been doing in terms of the curatorial program. Has been one to really show leadership in acquiring those works by artists of color, acquiring works by artists of different genders, and having a greater representation there. So that it was in many ways long overdue. And what we had to do in terms of our task was reflect that in the reinstallation. And where the collections were and what we were presenting was, where the museum was in the past. And so along with everything else that the museum has been doing programmatically, this was a logical next step for us to take. Now, it was very much a multi-year effort and a multi-pronged effort in terms of it's not simply one department doing something, but it was a complete reinstallation of the building from top to bottom. And
so what's an example of how it would look differently now?
Well, one of the things I'm especially proud of is what we were able to do by changing the physical location of certain collections and also changing the intellectual exchange between those collections. And I think it's perhaps most evident if you go to what is our top floor or skyway level of the Stent Wing, which is a Richard Meyer building, and the Whelan Pavilion, which is one of the Renzo Piano Pavilions. And you see the immediate relationship between aspects of our modern and contemporary collection and our folk and self-taught collections and our African art collections. And I think this is born out of a realization that we talked about. Not only how do we give greater prominence to aspects of our collection, which are quite important, certainly all three of those collections, as well as others, they have important key works that are unique to the High, that visitors here in Atlanta or visitors coming to Atlanta would want to see, but they're works of contemporary art or they're mm-hmm. works of modern art, and they all are, regardless of whether they were made in Africa or whether they were made in Georgia or whether they were made anywhere in the world. And I think it was important for us to underscore that relationship. And certainly this is something that some of our sister institutions have been doing. And I think it gave us a chance to say, for example, in our Folkin self-taught collection, be able to present some of the gifts from the Souls Grown Deep Foundation from the other year within the context of modern and contemporary art. So there's a, you can walk into those galleries and see works by Thornton Dial. You can walk in to the Folkin self-taught collections and see works of African art. You can see the African art in the Folkin self-taught in terms of creating the connections in terms of the legacy of that work. And that was a very deliberate and very carefully considered decision on the museum's part.
Well, for full disclosure, my in-laws are heavily involved in the Souls Grown Deep Foundation and have been advocating for inclusion for many, many decades. So just want to make that clear. But Floyd, you've been to the new museum or the new look?
I have, yes.
So what do you notice when you walk in?
You know, I think there's always this overarching narrative around the High Museum and where it fits within Atlanta's culture community. And so you mentioned the Skyway area there. I think that it's interesting to be able to go to and see the work in that space and see work from someone like Radcliffe Bailey, right? But then if you go to the art of you go to the Art of the Swats installation over near Greenbrier in the Westgate Shopping Center, and Radcliffe Bailey is on the wall over there.
Huh.
And so I think that there's always these different connections between the cultural legacy of a place and where the artists themselves end up. So I think that thinking about the work from that context, where the artists have come from, where they're going, but also just very much in an aesthetic way, it looks very visually stunning. I think that the pieces there are in a way, I think, reflective of what interests a lot of Atlantans right now. And so I think it was a great way, you know, a good a refresh, if you will.
Right. So one of the things that has happened in museum context before is this idea that there's a kind of barrier place between, you know, folk art. That's in one exhibition. That's in one place. Self-taught artists, outsider art, you know, the kind of terms that were used
sure.
at one point to say that this is not quite high art, are all integrated into one space. So what does that mean to see that, to take that in?
You know, this notion of breaking down barriers, to me, again, you know, it speaks to intention. And how do you go about doing that? And so, again, if you're going into that area and you're seeing work by Carol Walker, you're seeing work by Lonnie Holly, by Thornton Dial Sr., Richard Lockett. But then if you went to Afropunk a couple of weeks ago and Lonnie Holly's studio is over at that, I guess, that venue space there, you know, again, it just shows you where the artists themselves are situated. For those who are still living, but then also where their work ends up. And so I think it creates a different level of accessibility to the work in some of these more, quote unquote, mainstream spaces.
That's Floyd Hall. He's Arts ATL contributor. Kevin Tucker, chief curator for the High Museum in Atlanta, is also with us. I want to pick up on that what you said about SWATs. This is the Southwest Atlanta. There's a City of Atlanta program. It's Elevate, I think is the name of
Elevate,
the program.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that they did, T.I., the rapper, became a curator of arts for the community. And you spoke with the artist that he collaborated with. His name is Austin Blue. Let's hear what he had to say.
I didn't really realize until after I already started painting, like how many people were from this area. I met Miss Jackson from, you know, the Outkast song, I'm Sorry, Miss Jackson. I met Miss Jackson.
I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. I apologize a trillion times. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson.
That kind of got me hyped, you know, when I found out that there was a lot of rich musical history down here.
So there's a real connection to place, obviously. But, you know, so he said he didn't know what went on in that neighborhood. What happens when a public mural, a public piece of art, something that comes up and suddenly connects people to a different sense of place?
Well, hopefully you get a reset in terms of what people know about an area. And so I think T.I. is kind of having a big public art or just artistic moment right now besides just his music. So you have this collaboration, which is the Art of the Swats House for Elevate, where Austin Blue did a mural, and then T.I. curated the wheat paste images that are on top of that mural. And so you have a wide range of artists who have a connection to Southwest Atlanta or just that surrounding area. And so if you were to drive by that area now, this one building pops up or pops out, if you will, amidst a bit of a, you know, gray backdrop. And so for those who live in the area, they know there's a strong cultural history there, right? But if you were to drive by now, that may not be as apparent. And so what the city of Atlanta did, Austin Blue, T.I., they are creating a moment where folks can go and see some of the folks who've come from that area. So you have a Radcliffe Bailey, you have a Killer Mike, a T.I., you have a Ludacris, Outkast, obviously Goody Mob, Monica, 2 Chainz. And so you're able to visually represent to people what this area has been. And also, I think maybe harken back to some of the more vibrant cultural times when you look at that plaza where you had a Mr. V's Figure Eight, where you had a My Brother's Keeper, which were foundational places in Black culture in that area that really signaled community and place. And I think through visual art, some of these narratives are able to be told. And I think T.I. is really embracing the visual arts in a way now that maybe he has not before, because in addition to this, he's also curating the Trap Music Museum,
right,
which is a whole nother narrative, but also is visually telling the story of this very important subgenre of hip hop music in Atlanta.
Well, Kevin, the Killer Mike is on the board now of the High Museum
of
Art.
Yes, indeed.
But, you know, getting the community input, you're a curator. Obviously, you're concerned with the way that the museum is presented, its status, I think. And art history has been dominated by white European painters, let's face it.
Yeah.
The art that is valued, it gets higher sale prices, has meant higher status for museums. So what does this calculation mean for a museum now focused on diversifying its collection?
Well, I think it's an obligation that falls not only to the High, it falls to all art museums and all participants in all aspects of the art world, whether from the commercial side or from the nonprofit sector, the educational sector, to diversify our outlook. It's not a question of why are you doing this? It is more of a question of why not be doing this for all of us. And certainly what the High is doing, we're not alone in taking these steps, but it's a long road ahead of us. Mm-hmm. Because as you pointed out, there are hundreds of years, if not millennia, of biases in what is selected. And ultimately, art museums are about making those selections and choices and, in my profession, curating, if you want to use it as a verb, or being a curator and making those choices. And it's well time, it's well past the time for curators and for others in the field to be making better choices and opening their eyes and looking further afield to works that have been neglected. And this is true not only in the contemporary realm, but in historic art, and that's something that I've charged the curators to consider as well, is that for as much as we want to engage with artists in our community and artists nationally and internationally, and I think that's certainly a strength that the High brings to Atlanta, is being able to look at artists, whether they're truly from right here in the city or in Georgia or beyond, and putting them into this international context. But I've charged the curators dealing with historic art to do the same and to look deeper and to research more and to explore more. And I've been, you know, very proud to see works come into the collection by artists that have been neglected in the past. When we acquired this amazing sculpture that's from a Harlem Renaissance artist, William Artis, who was a sculptor and a ceramicist, and it's this, you know, beautiful, lovely head of a young woman, and very powerful and very moving piece. But you know, it's from 1930s work.
Right.
It's an earlier work, and you know, these are works that are difficult to find because they're not readily identified. There are collectors certainly that have a passion for the work, But there need to be more works like that in museums. They need to be recognized. They need to be chosen and selected and amplified and elevated to our community so that we understand the rich history and the legacy of artists of color and women artists who have been working just as long as any of those men.
So. Well, we have to close, and we're right up against a break. So one thing, when you walk into the museum now, what is the thing that's most gratifying for you to see?
I think it doesn't really matter unless the people respond to it, and that truly is the most satisfying. You know, we could have done all of this work, and you know, what if no one shows up? But instead, it's the faces, and it's the joy and seeing what people take away from seeing these expressions of creativity.
Kevin Tucker, Chief Curator for the High Museum of Atlanta. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Floyd Hall, we're going to be hearing more from you in the future. He's going to keep an eye on arts on the ground for us, but thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
He's ATL Arts ATL contributor and host of the Black Lana podcast. Coming up, Lauren Groff on her novel Florida, just nominated for a National Book Award. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn about the state's historic rural churches. We'll discuss their architecture and the sacred traditions that they inspired. Hope you'll join us for that. Lauren Groff never thought she would become a Floridian, but then she never expected to be name-checked by a president. In 2006, she moved to Gainesville for her husband's business. 9 years later, President Obama called her novel Fates and Furies his favorite book of the year. Groff's latest book, Florida, is now a finalist for the 2018 National Book Award. I spoke with her when the book first came out and asked her what she finds so intriguing about the state she now calls home.
I am so ambivalent about Florida. So I both absolutely adore it. I go for a run every single morning out in the prairie, and I see sort of the natural world, and I can, you know, there are always snakes underfoot and amazing birds that I wish that I could identify, sort of landing in the trees around me. It's a very stunning and beautiful, and there's a pour of sunshine over everything. But there is, at its heart, a very central strangeness. It's very swampy in its interior, Florida. And the natural world here, too, is both perilous, but also it's a gift. And the thing that I was looking at when I was trying to figure out how to put this story collection together was how do I look at Florida itself? What do I think of the name Florida? What does it mean to me? And to me, it means pervasive, ongoing dread. covered in sunlight, in golden, beautiful, stunning sunlight. So
I'm guessing Florida Tourist Board is not going to make you its spokesperson.
Well, perhaps they will if they want to make Florida even weirder than it is. Yes.
Well, there is this sense of danger underfoot, especially in places where humans meet the natural world. You know, there's like a snake coiled in the bathtub and an alligator not far from the dog pen, a sinkhole at the edge of the suburb. Does it feel like that to you, that you could just slide into some other realm?
It does feel like that to me, but it also feels like that in terms of being a parent in today's world to small children, right? I mean, I feel like just the act of having a child in the world is an act of danger, right? Because suddenly you have this heart taken out of your chest and made manifest in the world, and you can't control the world around your child. So I do think that that's the way I feel about the state, but it's also the way I feel about, you know, being a human in this current environment that we happen to be in right now.
Well, the danger of children is, it seems like, part of the theme here. There's a story, Dogs Go Wolf. It's about a pair of young sisters, their mother, all adults abandon them on this island. And at first, you know, it's fun. There's a big sister making up stories about princesses, but eventually they're eating chapstick to survive. You are a parent, but you're also a big sister. Was that your role with your little sister, kind of keeping her going?
This story did come out of a moment in my life when my sister was having a hard time, and I kept thinking how I could protect her. I mean, she's an adult now. She's in her mid-30s. She's a 2-time Olympic athlete. She's fine. She doesn't need me to protect her. But this is also something that I've been thinking about a lot about the world in general is how do we take care of the most vulnerable among us? I mean, we have to take care of the vulnerable people in our world. How do we do so? How do we make sure everybody is able to survive? How do we do these things? So the sense of peril comes from a larger, almost existential idea in that story.
Well, her answer to vulnerability is fantasy. And I can't help but think of Florida as Disney princess land. Did you have those kind of fantasies? Did you make up those kind of stories when you were a kid?
No, I've never liked princesses. I've always hated the whole narrative of the princess, because the narrative of the princess is your life basically ends as soon as you find love, right? I mean, it's almost as though a woman only exists in order to be an object of love or to have a love story. When in reality, I mean, I have an older brother, and I saw that he wasn't fed these narratives. He was fed the narrative that you go out and you have your adventure and your life is your adventure, and I resented the idea that my life would end as soon as I found love. So I actually truly dislike a lot of the narratives that we are force-fed and that we actually take in with, you know, our milk, with the media all around us. And I think one of the things that this collection does is that it opposes a lot of these narratives about what it means to be a mother and to seize that space, what it means to be domestic or domesticated, what it means to sort of resist the wild, but while also tempting the wild in. You know, I hate the cowboy mythos. I hate princesses. I hate the things that we are told that are skeletons of our narratives. And as we all know, narrative is the most important thing. If you control the narrative, you control everything right now.
You're reminding me of an appearance that I saw of you from 2016. This was on the Charlie Rose Show. Charlie Rose, we know what has happened to him since. But I just want to play it because it's pointing to something that you're talking about.
She had so much rage, right? So much rage. And I see this in myself, and I see this in a lot of my friends,
too. What
did
you have rage about?
One thing
you have rage about.
Well, it's not so much that I am unusual in my rage. It's that women are not necessarily allowed access, open access to our fury. Yeah.
Wait, stop.
Yes.
Women are not necessarily allowed open access to their fury.
Right.
Tell me what that means.
A bit of a pause there, Lauren Groff.
Yeah. Okay. I have so much to say
about
this.
Was
that a gasp? also, he talked over me that whole thing. But I would like to say I have felt guilty about this interaction the whole time. I was playing nice, and I was being a nice guest, and I could have just said, women have so much to be angry about. I mean, when we make 75 cents on the man's dollar and less for women of color, when we have to fight every day for our bodily autonomy, when we have lack of representatives in politics and business on the Supreme Court, I mean, everything. We have everything to be angry about. And yet I failed. I failed all feminists by not saying these things to Charlie Rose and by not standing up for women at that moment. So I feel very ambivalent hearing that clip.
Well, you just got to make it up, right?
This may not be
Charlie Rose's audience, but besides being in the position of woman-splaining female rage to Charlie Rose, when you heard about the accusations against them, did you have any perspective on the way that he understood or maybe thought about women?
No, because he was kind to me, right? He was being very nice. He did interrupt me, you know, and I think I am more used to that than a man would be. I don't have any perspective on him. I'm sad because I like to watch his shows, but I believe women. You know, you have to believe women these days, and we have to all be allies to each other, men included. In fact, men need to step up and start being better allies.
We're speaking with Lauren Groff. She's out with a new collection of short stories called Florida. Well, there are women characters. In fact, one that seems to pop up, a mother of two, like you, and a writer, not originally from Florida. So her feelings about the South seem pretty ambivalent, as you said you feel about Florida. What do you think it is that most people, Southerners included, even here in Georgia, don't get about Florida?
I think there's a lot of contempt about the state and the people who live here. And I'm not quite sure I know where it comes from. I think part of it is just the fact that we sort of dangle off the rest of the continental U.S. We are the most south you could possibly be. And there are a lot of overriding narratives that are just insane. I mean, people talk about Florida as though it's God's waiting room because there's so many old people. And they talk about Florida in the context of Florida Man, you know, the person on Twitter who every time something bad happens in the U.S., some guy walks into a store and sticks up the store with, like, his banana that comes from Florida, right? And so the perception is that Florida is kind of ridiculous. And I don't think it is. I think it's really interesting. I think it's there are parts of it that are hilarious and strange and unusual. But there's a lot of contempt that I guess I had to get over myself as a transplant. And I think that a lot of other people, it's even other Southerners, hold in their hearts for Florida.
Not projecting that this woman is you because she's a writer and she has two kids. But the last and the longest story, this woman comes back again. And she's traveled to France in this story. And it's there that she disappointedly realizes she may belong in Florida more than anywhere else. What is drawing her back there?
Right. So this character is not me. And I did have an experience. I took my own two little boys to France when they were 6 and 4 by myself, which I would not make my worst enemy do that. It's a terrible thing to do. And we had some fun. But I did realize halfway through that where my children are happy is where I need to be now. And it seemed like it was both clarifying but also deeply dispiriting because I do value autonomy and independence so much. But when you're a parent, you don't necessarily get that choice, and you shouldn't necessarily have that choice all the time. So that was an intensely complicated moment in my own personal life and also the life of the character.
She says, of all the places in the world, she belongs in Florida. How dispiriting to learn this of herself.
Right. I mean, there are days when I think, you know, I could wake up in Paris. I could wake up in Tuscany or in Japan and have a different life, but I would carry myself there. And I am this almost 40-year-old person who has so much baggage. You can't get away from your own baggage. And Florida is everywhere now. Wherever I go, I am in Florida.
Well, you're reminding me of this kind of multiple perspectives, the voice of a character, right? In Fates and Furies, this was a he said, she said, opposite sides of the same story, telling their story of their time together, not necessarily the same at all. So that's not something that, you know, you're going to be able to do in another novel. you've kind of done that one, right? And the surprise is there. But most of the stories in Florida do have one voice, but it allows you to tell stories from countless perspectives. So how do you get inside the heads of so many different characters?
So in a novel, it's just something that you apply yourself to very calmly on a daily basis. And eventually there's accumulation of pages and attrition of fear and you have a thing. But with short stories for me, they're closer to poetry for me. So they come out in this ecstatic burst, and usually they come out multiple times. One time in an ecstatic burst, and I look at it and I think, this is terrible, I throw it out. And then I put it back into the subconscious to be embroidered bordered upon for years and then take it back out again when it feels necessary or urgent. So it's really just the process of writing a short story. They come out over the course of years in which, you know, I've thought through these characters really deeply. But that's the beautiful thing about representing a state like Florida that actually cannot be pinned down because there's no single reality. You can do it in short stories because you can do it in a multiplicity of voices and a multiplicity of characters and still feel like you're saying something about a state, that geographical state, but also a psychological state.
You said something about putting it back in the unconscious. Is there a process for that, or you just sort of, you know, put it down there while you're doing the dishes or making dinner or something like that?
Yeah, no, the process
is really... I'm
sorry,
those were totally gendered examples, by the way.
Yeah, no, my husband does the dishes, by the way. So, no, I don't... It's not conscious, right? And I think that when we are receptive to our subconsciousness as artists, that's when the really good work happens. So I think that a lot of times I really do just throw out all my drafts. So if I were to do a story, throw it out, throw it back into the subconscious, and let it sit there, if it ever comes out again, it needs to be told. If it doesn't come out again, that's fine. It didn't need to be told, right? Mm-hmm. Or I haven't yet found the way to tell the story that I wanted to tell. So it's more about keeping things mysterious and opaque rather than forcing them into the light prematurely.
You really have to trust that process then, don't you?
Oh, you do. Oh, yes, you do. And there are years when I don't write anything good, and that's okay, too. You have to trust that if you sit down and do the work daily, faithfully, someday something good will happen.
One of the other things that strikes me about these stories is there's a lot that is unspoken. You know, the hurt that a woman never shares with her husband, or the boy that hides his genius from numbers from his teachers and his classmates. Is that a Southern thing? Is that a human thing, that hiding?
Yeah, I think it's a human thing. I do. And I think that we all have these internal lives that nobody else gets a glimpse of. And I think that's what makes us beautiful, strange humans. I mean, if you sit down and you actually talk to another person for a long time, a stranger, they will show their weirdness to you so quickly. And the weirdness comes out of this internal life that they have that is not glimpsable unless they allow you to share it. And I think that that's a true, true generosity and beauty of humanity.
Lauren Groff, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you, Virginia.
Author Lauren Groff. Her latest book of short stories, Florida, is now a finalist for the National Book Award. And that is our show for today. Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor produce On Second Thought. Our engineer is Alex Word, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. Special thanks to our Dean of Grammar, Don Smith. You can stay in touch with us at OST Talk on Twitter. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott, GPB, on Facebook. Happy to have you with us for On Second Thought.